Welcome to episode 19. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. Starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health, we've had a first initial meeting with the HWU following its log of claims. Members will recall that that log of claims was vastly different to an earlier log of claims and far more direct. As part of that meeting, we talked about the fact that the circumstances under which community health now operates have vastly changed since the last time negotiations took place, having regard for My Aged Care and NDIS. Community health members will have also received a questionnaire from us. That questionnaire can be broken up into three distinct components. The first of which is which of the current clauses have created issues during the life of the agreement, which clauses, if you were to have consistent clauses across agreements, would you choose, and are there any flexibility items that you would seek to establish. We have had also a further discussion with VAPA with regards to community health. Members will recall that to date, six community health centres have received logs of claim only, and we are in discussions with regards to the establishment of a protocol to support bargaining. We anticipate that with the next HRIR managers meeting that we'll be able to discuss that proposed protocol before going any further. With respect to the acute sector, the Nurses Agreements relevant committees, particularly the STPPWG and the Occupational Health and Safety Industry Group, have each met and dates have been set for 2017. We'll be posting updates on the VHA community app before and after each of those meetings so that members can be across the issues that are being discussed. With respect to medical scientists, the drafting process is just in the process of, is just being completed. With respect to allied health professionals, that agreement is now operative, but we would be interested in hearing from members with regards to any operational issues that they experience. The reference group will be paying attention in particular to the issue of advanced practice before too long. In terms of the health and allied agreement, we have some confirmed dates from the department with regards to the STPPWG. We'll be seeking to confirm those with the HWU shortly. And with respect to the mental health agreement, we anticipate that there will be a forum to discuss the terms in depth of the mental health agreement in early June. We'll be considering how we make that particular forum available to everyone, including through videotape. That's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. Joining me for this week's discussion is Principal Workplace Relations Advisor and Eurovision Song Contestant, Tim Nagel. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Stuart.
Would you do the honours for this week's subject box? So for the benefit of those people who are listening rather than watching this broadcast, would you describe the object that you see there?
It's a scale.
Tim, you couldn't be more wrong. This particular thing is an instrument used for jewellery making, and what it does is it converts size into carats. It also operates as this fantastic pendant that could be worn by Flavor Flav of Public Enemy. What it does is it converts things. So today's subject is casual conversion. Tim, the current round of agreements, many of them have a provision with respect to casual conversion. In particular, the nurses and midwives, health and allied and managers and administrative officers, as well as the allied health professionals. But not all agreements have that provision.
No, for the last round, the one that doesn't contain a casual conversion clause is most notably the mental health agreement.
And what's the reason for that?
So there was some, so as people would know, the clauses across those other agreements allow for both parties to initiate the casual conversion.
Either the employee or the employer?
Yes, and really we thought there was a shared goal between the parties to increase or promote permanency of employment. But unfortunately, the fact that the employer could initiate that process was a barrier in the mental health agreement, our bargaining process.
So for the purpose of today, we'll be talking about the Nurses and Midwives Agreement, the Allied Health Professionals Agreement, as well as the Health and Allied Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement.
Yes, that's right.
And before we talk about the casual conversion clause, we should perhaps take one step back and talk about casual employment more generally. Each of those agreements has a definition for casual employment. If we start with what they have in common, each of the four agreements have a particular element of that definition that is the same across each of them.
Yes, yeah, so they talk about casual workers being of a relieving... They talk about casual work being relieving work or work of a casual nature.
So just in terms of that term, relieving work, that term of itself is not the subject of a definition within the agreements, but so it can mean a range of different things.
Yeah, so it implies a replacement position, so covering someone on leave or, say, personal leave or annual leave or workers' compensation or something where they're replacing some existing work being undertaken.
And I guess it also could go to work that is, for instance, temporary by its nature because of a workload peak.
Yeah, potentially.
The other key term in that definition is work of a casual nature. Now, that's not a reference to dress code.
No. So this is really about the model of engagement between the employee and the employer. So it talks a little bit about expectation of work and frequency of work as well.
So a couple of the agreements, notably the nurses and midwives and the allied health professionals, have an additional statement as part of their definition of what casual employment is. And that statement sort of adds something, I guess, to the first one.
Yeah, so this talks about the definition of casual not including employees who may more probably be classified as a part-timer or a full-timer.
I think for me that part of the definition reinforces that whether or not somebody is a casual is not solely a matter of election, but the character of the engagement itself.
Exactly, and I think that's an important part to differentiate between casual and other forms of engagement.
And I think that goes a little bit to the characteristics of casual employment of itself. For starters, they receive a loading.
Yeah, so they receive a 25% loading.
There are a number of paid leave entitlements that they don't receive.
So such as personal leave and annual leave.
And in terms of part of what that 25% compensates someone for is for the fact that the work is casual.
That's right.
The thing that strikes me about that, though, is so casual work is more expensive for an employer. Whilst you're compensating someone for the fact that their employment can be terminated without notice, at a certain point, if the engagement continues beyond a certain time and has a certain character, it may be that the person has protections for unfair dismissal, for example.
Yeah, so the Fair Work Act recognises periods of casual employment in certain circumstances.
So for me, there is a significant benefit in making sure that a casual engagement is utilised in a circumstance that is appropriate for casual engagement. Otherwise, you end up paying for something that you're not getting.
That's right, exactly.
So if we turn, first of all, then to the casual conversion clauses themselves under the agreements, and for those people who are listening, we're talking about Clause 20 of the Nurses and Midwives Agreement, Clause 16 in the Health and Allied part of the Health and Allied Services Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement, and then Clause 15 in the Managers component, and Clause 21 of the Allied Health Professionals EBA. There's a significant degree of commonality, and indeed this is one of the common clauses. There are a couple of minor variations between them that it's worth bringing people's attention to or directing their attention to. So if we start with the first subclause, which is common across each of those agreements.
So this is really the trigger clause in the trigger subclause, which says that where a casual employer's work shifts on a regular and systematic basis over a period of 26 weeks or more, the employer and employee recognise that the employee may be more properly classified as part-time or full-time.
So that is, at a certain point, it's the case that casual employment may no longer be the best fit for the engagement that is occurring.
That's right. Now that relates to the period of time that's been in place, being 26 weeks.
So the interesting thing for me is that clause requires a couple of things. It's that you work in a particular way, that is on a regular and systematic basis, and it requires that you work on that in that particular way for a particular period of time, at least that particular period of time being a number of weeks.
That's right.
And the number of weeks is?
26 weeks.
So if you are working on a regular and systematic basis for 26 weeks or more, then it may be there is some acknowledgement that casual may not be the best fit. Just in terms of one of the frequently asked questions I think that we have had during the course of our forums is, when does that period of time, when does that 26 weeks run from?
So the 26, I guess it's at any period of time, or well, the most recent period of time is what would be considered in the as a trigger. So it doesn't, it could have been before the agreements. It doesn't commence from the agreement commencement. It is the last 26 weeks.
So it's not 26 weeks after the agreement came into operation. It can proceed or be a mix of before and after the agreement came into operation.
That's right.
If we move to the second subclause of the casual conversion provision, which again is identical across each of those agreements, that second clause provides for what?
So the second clause reads that the employee will not be considered rostered on a regular and systematic basis where these shifts are replacing employee absence, and then in brackets, including but not limited parental leave, long service leave, workers' compensation and personal leave, or a flexible work arrangement.
What's interesting about that is it's not a definition as to what a regular and systematic is, but what regular and systematic is not.
So it excludes particular circumstances.
And just in terms of those circumstances, each of those examples connects to someone else.
Yeah, that's right. So really the principle here is that casual employees shouldn't be made permanent where that permanency impacts upon other people's shifts.
And that's a key principle.
That's right.
There is a minor difference between the expression across the agreements, and that goes to the reference to the flexible work arrangement. In the case of the health and allied agreement, across both parts, it describes that as a temporary flexible work arrangement. Whilst there is a minor difference in the wording, for me there is no difference in terms of the substance.
It's the same principle. So if that's other people's shifts, then it shouldn't be included or should be excluded by the clause.
That's right. If a flexible work arrangement is not temporary, then it's not really a flexible work arrangement, it's a variation, and that person who is the subject of that arrangement, who has requested it, doesn't still then retain the right to return to those shifts, that is, they don't belong to someone else at that point.
Yeah, it changes the circumstance that you're trying to preserve on a temporary basis.
So for those members who do notice that minor difference in the wording, it has no material impact, it's the same principle.
That's right.
In terms of the third subclause, again, that's another one that is absolutely identical across each of the agreements.
And how it reads is that either the employer or the employee may request in writing the conversion of the employee to full-time or part-time employment, and then it says in brackets, whichever is applicable, and such requests will not be unreasonably refused by either party.
So there are a number of elements in that subclause, and the first of which is the request has to be in writing.
And look, often, more often than not, these procedural clauses require the first step to be in writing. And I think that's really useful in where there's a dispute or a concern or to promote clarity between the parties, is that recording of the actual proposal in writing so that the parties have got something to base the subsequent conversation on.
So the other element that stands out is that the request can be made by either the employee or the employer. Regardless of who initiates the discussion, the request must be in writing.
And again, this is about permanency of employment should be in the interests of both the employer and the employee. I mean, there's a lot of advantages to having a stable permanent workforce from both an employee and an employer perspective. So this really recognises that joint goal in promoting permanency.
I think the phrase, whichever is applicable, is always one that bears some examination, and that goes to whether or not it's to full-time or to part-time. In terms of that expression, whichever is applicable, when will full-time be applicable and when will part-time be applicable?
Really, I think this is about the number of hours that they're completing on a casual basis. So if they're doing, 16 hours a week, and that's the work pattern that's sort of been pronounced over the last 6 months, then it's not a conversion to full-time, it's a conversion to part-time.
It's the shifts that fit the regular and systematic pattern. It's not an invitation to renegotiate.
No, I mean, the work needs to be available. So if you're doing 16 hours a week, then it's really talking about that amount of work that you may convert into. It's not about extending the work required.
And the other key element with regards to that clause is that the request, whether the request is made to the employee or to the employer, not be unreasonably refused.
Yeah, so again, there may be reasons why, for whatever reason, that it is unreasonable for that conversion to occur. This is about having that conversation, and as part of that conversation and to promote permissive employment, that's the threshold that the parties think is reasonable in the circumstances.
So it turns on all the circumstances, and it's not possible to countenance all those circumstances. I think what it requires both employees and employers to do is to actively turn their mind to the reasons that they're considering. And I think as a general rule of thumb, if you can't articulate the reason for the refusal, or if you can't easily articulate, then it's probably appropriate to question whether the refusal is unreasonable.
Yeah, it sort of becomes self-evident when people think about, well, why wouldn't they? If there's no good reason, then it's probably going to fall within the parameter of not unreasonably refusing the request.
And for those people who have to deal with systems and the like, what it means is that a blanket refusal is unlikely or almost certain not to meet that test of being reasonable.
And the blanket refusal or the blanket policies are really where organisations can get themselves in trouble. A lot of these clauses and a lot of these types of clauses are around promoting adaption to the needs of the individuals involved. And really to do that, you need to think about the exact circumstances confronting you. So blanket rules won't do that. In fact, that's the opposite of considering the individual circumstances. So for organisations, they really must turn their mind to examining what the exact circumstances are in each case that's proposed.
Now, it's at this point that the clauses do diverge a little bit. So the health and allied in both its parts, that is the managers and administrative workers, as well as the allied health professionals, have an additional procedural statement. Particularly, it states that where a request is made, that there must be a written response within 21 days.
Yeah, and look, I think that's the reason when the circumstances. Again, the two components to that is that the response is in writing, and we know that more often than not, these procedural processes do have that writing requirement so that both parties are clear about the reasons for the refusal, because that then goes to whether it's been unreasonably refused.
So I think the time frame is interesting, 21 days, and that's important to it to apply. But in the event that it's a refusal, that the reasons are stated, it's very difficult to reasonably refuse something if you don't state the reasons.
Oh, that's right. I mean, it doesn't really make sense. So I think the reason needs to be included in that response, and it needs to be very clear.
So just in terms of the nurses' agreement, which doesn't have that procedural step, would you recommend that the same approach be taken?
I would, yes. I mean, I think that it's in the interest of the employer, if they do have a very good reason, to be able to articulate that reason, because really that's what's going to help the employee understand why their request isn't being made, if they're very clear about what the reasons are. And of course, the time frame of 21 days, that's not overly onerous. So I think that's quite a reasonable time to respond in.
There's also an additional subclause, again, under the Health and Allied Managers and Administrative Workers and the Allied Health Professionals Agreement with regards to how the hours are then set in the event that a conversion from casual to part-time or full-time occurs.
So in terms of... And I think, I mean, that links in a little bit with the Health and Allied requirements for part-time workers, and they have hours fixed. Which, again, for both the pays, makes it clear about what the arrangements are moving forward.
There was one query that was raised as to what if some of the hours fit the description of regular and systematic and don't belong to someone else, and some of them don't fit that description. So some of them do meet the test and some of them don't, because that clause potentially suggests it's all or nothing.
Mm. Well, I think the parties need to be take a pragmatic approach to these sort of matters, so to limit it to those that do meet the definition I think would be reasonable in the circumstances, because, again, it's going to have to meet that test anyway about only being refused on reasonable grounds. So my advice in those circumstances would be to limit it to those sections of the hours which do meet the test.
And look, once again, the nurses' agreement doesn't have that express provision, but they are really statements of the obvious. You would recommend the same approach?
I would, yes.
So those two items are the ones where the clauses diverge slightly, that is the requirement for a written response and how the hours are set, notwithstanding that, in our view, the same approach should be taken across each agreement. The next provision, they're back on point, that is with regards to the issuing of a letter of appointment.
Yeah, this is really just to confirm what has been agreed between the parties, which is really more for future clarity than anything else.
I think the requirement is also, what's interesting about that letter of appointment is that it requires that there be an acknowledgement as to the casual service as well.
Yes, that's right.
We talked before about the fact that there are a couple of additional subclauses that apply under some agreements, but not the nurses. The nurses has one subclause that the others don't. And again, I suspect it falls into the category of statement of the overwhelmingly obvious, and that is that the casual loading will cease at the point of conversion and any permanent entitlements begin when the person becomes permanent.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I agree that's a statement of the obvious. In circumstances where people are converting from casual to part-time or full-time, then all the associated entitlements and go along with that.
So we would recommend, notwithstanding that it's only in the nurses' agreement, that the same approach be taken across the board.
I think so. I mean, again, a lot of this is just common sense written in different ways. So I think the same approach does make sense, so therefore it's transferable across the different agreements.
By having it in the agreement, it also provides a way of resolving that dispute.
That's right, yeah.
So it's a new provision for some of the agreements, not the mental health agreement. That's taken effect. I guess it's always possible, because it is a new clause, that there'll be a variety of interpretations. But we would ask that if people do experience any difficulty with regards to the interpretation of the clause, to let us know.
I think and that's right. I mean, one of the questions that have come up about the casual conversion clause is around the circumstances where the work's not ongoing. So it could have been more appropriately classified as a fixed term appointment. And look, the advice in those circumstances is that probably, yes, you could have looked at a fixed term appointment, but whether the work's ongoing, I think, also leads into whether you can reasonably refuse the request as well.
It's interesting that really takes us back to that issue of what is the character of the engagement, having regard for all the circumstances.
That's right.
Tim, thank you so much for taking us through the new casual conversion provisions.
Thanks for having me here, Stuart.